You're listening to the station that takes you off the beaten track from the University of Victoria, CFUV, 101.9 FM, 104.3 on cable, and on the internet, cfuv.uvic.ca.
Welcome to Guerrilla Radio on CFUV 101.9 FM, 104.3 on your cable dial, and you know we are heard around the world at cfuv.uvic.ca. Well, one of the greatest problems we as a species face, and so face the rest of life on this planet, is our lack of awareness. For centuries, the prophets have urged we humans awake our slumber and become aware of ourselves and our environment. In times past, relatively small human populations and technological limitations allowed our ignorance continue without entirely wasting the planet. But those blissful days are done. Today, both the size and complexity of human enterprise threaten the biosphere we and the rest of the biological beings on Earth need for survival. Lierre Keith is a longtime sustainability activist, feminist, editor, and author whose book titles include Conditions of War, Skylar Gabriel, and her latest book, The Vegetarian Myth, Food, Justice, and Sustainability. Keith writes, quote, "I want a full accounting, an accounting that goes way beyond what's dead on your plate. I'm asking about everything that died in the process, everything that was killed to get that food onto your plate." Lierre Keith in the first half. And in Great Britain, hearings are being conducted into just how that country became entangled in the Iraq War. Astonishing testimony was released last week regarding secret meetings held between George W. Bush and Tony Blair that suggest the two men plotted the invasion well before any of the supposed justifications for such an action were merited. The astonishing part in all this is the British media's feigned surprise at facts established nearly 8 years ago. Dave Lindorf is an award-winning investigative reporter and author active in journalism for more than three decades. He is the author of the books This Can't Be Happening, Resisting the Disintegration of American Democracy, Marketplace Medicine, The Rise of the For-Profit Hospital Chains, Killing Time, an investigation into the death row case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, and co-author with Barbara Olshansky of The Case for Impeachment, Legal Arguments for Removing George W. Bush from Office. Dave Lindorf and Britain's Tardy Commission on that country's involvement in the invasion and occupation of Iraq in the second half, and Victoria Street News publisher and CFUV broadcaster Janine Bancroft will join us at the bottom of the hour to bring us up to speed with some of the goings-on in and around Victoria. But first, Lierre Keith and Breaking the Vegetarian Myth. Stick around. Well, welcome to the show, Lierre.
Thanks for having me.
Well, my great pleasure, of course. Now, Lierre, it's often said that going vegetarian is one of the greatest things an individual can do to lessen her ecological footprint. Now, in your book, you argue, well, that's just not enough. Now, what are the vegetarians and vegans in the crowd missing here, Lierre?
The problem is that agriculture is the single most destructive activity that humans have done to the planet. So more of the same will not save us. And I wanted to say very clearly that the ethics that underlie the vegetarian worldview are not at issue.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that most people who are motivated to become vegans or vegetarians are motivated out of a sense of justice, compassion, a longing for sustainability, and certainly a questioning of human entitlement and human hubris.
Mm-hmm.
Now, those are the only values that are going to get us to the sustainable world that we need. So that's not the problem. The problem is information. And we've been living in an agricultural society for 10,000 years. And more recently, over the last 200 years, we've been living in the industrial version, which is sort of, you know, the whole thing on steroids. And we don't understand how damaging this is because we don't live in the natural world anymore. So that is really the problem, that agriculture is an inherently destructive activity. And at this point, we've made ourselves dependent on a way of life that is literally killing the planet.
Well, now, you write about your introduction as a schoolgirl, the introduction, rather, of agriculture as it pertains to human civilization. And I was taught the same thing, that, you know, there was the hunter-gatherers, which were, you know, almost a Neanderthal, or behaving in exactly the same manner. And then there was this great diversion when agriculture was invented, you know, around Iraq and Egypt, as you say, 10,000 years ago. Well, gee whiz, Lier, now what else is there? I mean, how can you define what you mean by agriculture? Is there a big A agriculture, little A agriculture? I mean, we've all got to eat, right?
Yeah, well, first of all, this is a myth. And, you know, history is written by the victors. So they've written this myth about agriculture and why it started. The truth is that, you know, the archaeological record is very clear. People lived very, very healthy lives until the beginning of agriculture. If you show a set of bones to anyone who's a medical anthropologist, they can tell you in 5 seconds whether those bones belong to a hunter-gatherer or an agriculturalist, because the hunter-gatherer bones are long and strong and disease-free, and the agriculturist bones are a mess. The first thing that happens when people start doing agriculture is they shrink 6 inches, and their bones become riddled with diseases, autoimmune diseases, you know, contagious diseases. All of this takes over. The reason that people took up agriculture was not hunger. You do not see signs of chronic hunger in hunter-gatherer bones. Hunger does not become institutionalized into human society until after agriculture. So this was not about human hunger or overpopulation. Hunter-gatherers are really good at keeping their populations in check. It's agriculture that lets the human population grow to such extraordinary numbers. So that's, you know, the myth that we've been told, but it's not true. It's really a lie that was told by the victors. So what agriculture is, in very brute terms, you take a piece of land, you clear every living thing off it, and I mean down to the bacteria, and then you plant it to human use. So it's biotic cleansing, because instead of sharing that land with, you know, millions of other creatures who should be living there, it's only used for humans now. Those other creatures have nowhere else to go. That is a nice way of saying extinction. So that's one problem, is the extinction. Number two is that you're going to let the human population grow to really large numbers because you're not sharing that land. The real problem is that this is overshoot. The only way to keep doing agriculture is to destroy the soil. The soil actually needs the permanent cover of trees or grasslands or wetlands. That is the pattern that nature has evolved. By doing agriculture, of course, we destroy all of that, and we draw down the resources of the soil. You mentioned Iraq and the Middle East. Well, those used to be oak savannas and pine forests so deep the sun never hit the ground. And 10,000 years later, nobody in their right mind would call that place the Fertile Crescent. It's nothing but salt, sand, and scrub. And that is the end trajectory of agriculture around the planet. It's a very, very destructive activity. There is no way to do it sustainably. And this is the terrible fact that this culture does not want to face.
Well, I mean, from my understanding, and I'm sure the majority of the people listening tonight, Lier, that permaculture and not monocropping, but mixed use on a small plot, milpa is what the Mayans call it. You know, they've got these little milpa gardens in the jungle. They have a balanced diet between hunting and their plantings, but. I mean, when you say that you strip down the land and you kill everything living, well, that's not the way that this kind of farming. I mean, yes, maybe the corn crops and sprayed with Monsanto, Roundup Ready, and all that happens. But are you saying that by doing a sustainable or permaculture style mixed use plantings, that as well kills everything in the soil?
I would make a huge distinction, because when I say agriculture, I'm talking about annual monocrops.
We're talking about modern agriculture.
Not just modern, because this has been going on for 10,000 years, but monocrops. So they're annuals and they're monocrops. If you're talking about a permaculture system, that is based on perennials. The skeleton of those systems is either trees or grasses. That can be sustainable because it's based on nature's model. In order to plant the annual monocrops, you have to clear the soil. Those seeds, because they're annuals, so you have to understand the difference between annuals and perennial plants. Mm-hmm. Annuals only grow for a season or two. Perennials are much longer lived. And because they're perennials, they have a very, very complicated, dense root system. They hold the soil in place, They have a tremendous function in terms of providing nutrients for the soil, and that actually the matrix that holds the whole thing in. And so because they're perennials and they're long-lived, they don't actually have to produce much in the way of seeds because they can reproduce in other ways. They have time because they're long-lived. The problem with the annual crops is that they only have a season or two, and so they produce these really large seed heads because that's their only reproductive strategy. In order for that seed to grow, the land has to be cleared. And annuals in nature have a really important role, and that is when the land, when there's some kind of destructive event, like a fire or a flood or an earthquake, and the land is cleared temporarily, the annuals are the first responders. So just like if you cut your hand and you put a Band-Aid on it, that's what the annuals do. They are the Band-Aid that covers the bare soil, because that bare soil is a biological emergency. Okay, soil is the basis of life, mm-hmm. and nature will do everything in its power to cover that soil again. So annuals are the Band-Aid, and then your skin would knit back together, right, and you wouldn't need the Band-Aid anymore. Well, that's what happens in nature. The perennial plants, again, will bit by bit cover up that land, and the annuals disappear. In the process, their seeds have dropped into the soil, and they wait. And they will lie in wait for a very long time until their moment comes again, which is some kind of disaster in the future. Now, the problem is that those big seed heads are worth harvesting for humans. So humans began to do this and got addicted to, those seeds. They actually contain a fair amount of opioids, and that's really the reason we started doing agriculture. And in order to plant them, the land has to be cleared. And that clearing activity, again, is inherently destructive. The moment you put a plow to soil, you destroy that soil. So if you've got a food system that's based on annual monocrops, you are drawing down the reserves of the earth. You are destroying the ecosystems. What I say is that agriculture is carnivorous and what it eats is entire continents. Now, to contrast that to a kind of permaculture system or the kinds of traditional methods that hunter-gatherers used in forests and on prairies and in savannas, completely different because the land is not cleared. It is based on those perennials. So it's based on either trees or grasses. And that has every potential to be sustainable. Of course, you can find examples of destructive things that hunter-gatherers have done. But as long as it's based on a skeleton of perennial plants, you at least have a chance, because this is the only way that nature can preserve and build more topsoil. And that's the problem. Culture is actually the beginning of global warming. If you take all the carbon that humans have added to the atmosphere since the beginning of the industrial age, which is about 1800, all of that carbon, if you back up your time frame about 10,000 years to the beginning of agriculture, the same amount of carbon has been added to the atmosphere during agriculture because it's an inherently destructive activity. The planet does not want to be an annual monocrop. It wants to be that perennial cover of forests and tundras and wetlands. And by destroying all that, we released a huge amount of carbon into the atmosphere. The only hope that we have is to restore our planet to the state that she wants to be. If just for instance, I mean, and this is a great moment of hope for all of us, if we took all the agricultural land in the United States, essentially east of the Dakotas, we put it back into the grassland and the prairie that it wants to be, the United States would immediately become a net carbon sink. That is the only way we are going to reverse global warming. But we have to step back and understand first that agriculture has been 10,000 years destroy, 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 destroy. And we've got to reverse that process and repair, 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 repair.
Well, is it possible to tear up the parking lots of Walmart or all the Walmarts in America and actually rehabilitate the land and go back to a healthy topsoil and top cover? Is that possible after it's been paved over?
After it's been paved, unlikely. I mean, the earth can recover from just about anything besides asphalt. And that's a lot of land, but way more land has been covered with these annual monocrops of soy and rice and wheat, and it's a lot more likely that we could take that land and put it back into prairie. The earth will help us. If we get out of the way, it will happen naturally. But we could certainly be putting all of our efforts into restoring the forests and the prairies and then learn again to be members of that soil-building community instead of destroyers of it. It's really only been the last 10,000 years that human culture has become monstrous. I mean, before that, we knew how to participate in those cycles and we knew our place. we didn't destroy the entire world in order to get our food. So what I like to say is, you know, we need to take our food from inside those living communities instead of imposing ourselves across them. And agriculture is an imposition, and it's a very destructive imposition. And I would really like the people who care the most about this planet to understand this so that we can develop a way better strategy than what we've been handed. Eating more wheat and soy and corn is not going to save this planet. Those are not plants that this planet wants us to grow on any kind of mass scale. She really would like her prairies and her forests back.
Well, if you just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria, 104.3 on the cable, and cfuv.uvic.ca on the internet everywhere else. I'm speaking tonight with Liara Keith, and she is a longtime sustainability activist, a feminist editor and author. Her book titles include Conditions of War, the novel Skylar Gabriel, and her latest book, The Vegetarian Myth, Food, Justice, and Sustainability. Well, you mentioned we have to get out of the way, and you also mentioned that these vast populations of humans were engendered by agriculture, small A, I'll call it, and now modern big A agriculture. Well, how many of us have to get out of the way, Lear, how many of us humans have to get out of the way for the kind of restoration that you envision?
It's a really tough question, not because the number is hard to come up with, but because emotionally, it's no fun to have to face the corner that we have backed ourselves into. I mean, this is really a cliff that we're hanging over at this point. You know, some people say that the year 1800 is really the population number we should be looking for, because the year 1800 is when the industrial age starts. So the addition of fossil fuel has added about 7 billion people to the planet. That's a lot of people. So the year 1800, there were 1 billion people on the planet. So a lot of sustainability writers use that as their sort of benchmark. The problem with that number is that it doesn't take into account the fact that agriculture itself is drawdown. It will never be sustainable. As long as you are using up species, ecosystems, and ultimately the soil, you're drawing down those resources. You're turning living creatures into resources that can just produce more humans. And, you know, by the year 1950, in fact, the world was out of topsoil. So it was already over. What happened at that point was the Green Revolution. So what happened was that humans learned to use fossil fuel to actual food and eating oil ever since. Obviously, this is not going to be sustainable, but, you know, those first 10,000 years where we were slowly drawing down the topsoil, that's drawdown. That is never going to be sustainable. So, you know, to look back to the very beginning of the agricultural age, there were somewhere between 300 million and 600 million people on the planet. We may not like that number. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really matter how we feel about it. One way or another, our numbers will be reduced to sustainable numbers again because the planet simply can't support us. Now, if as a culture, as a society, as a species, if we could sit down and rationally look at the cliff that we've backed ourselves off of, we could make way better decisions. When people have the correct information about, in fact, how many resources there are to support us, they will make rational decisions. Hunter-gatherers, like I said, are very good at keeping their numbers in check because the correspondences are really tight. You know right away that you've overshot, and everybody is hungry by the next year. So they know the exact ratio of adults, productive adults, to dependents that they can support, you know, as a group. Agriculture breaks those correspondences. So even while you're drawing down and destroying, you know, the land base, human population keeps growing and growing and growing, and you don't realize what you've done until the entire thing collapses. Now, it used to be that these human civilizations were limited because of, you know, we didn't have fossil fuels. So, you know, this is a military process in the end. When you destroy your own land base, you've got to go out and get resources from somewhere else. And this is the pattern of civilizations, where you have this bloated power center, and then around them are conquered colonies. And that conquering could only go distance. It could only go as far as humans and pack animals could get in a reasonable amount of time to keep the empire going. Eventually, it would collapse because all those resources would be used up, and then in 100 years or 200 years, the thing would spring up somewhere else. But that's the pattern throughout Asia, throughout Africa, throughout Europe, throughout South America. That's been the nature of civilization. So it's militarized. It involves imperialism. It involves a great deal of human slavery, and it involves just destruction of the land base everywhere. So in order for us to face all this, I'm not saying this is going to be an easy process, but we don't have a lot of choice. And this is another reason why I take great issue with the strategies that we are being led toward by especially the environmental movement. There are no personal solutions to this. We do need a culture of resistance and an actual resistance movement that will face the huge social forces that are behind the destruction of our planet.
Well, this is about as close to a catastrophic interview that I've held, and I've been doing this for a long time, Leah.
I'm very sorry.
But, I mean, and okay, so 95% of us have to get out of the way by the sounds of it to go back to at least a beginning point. Well, I mean, that's not going to happen politically. It may happen just by necessity or by some natural catastrophe or something. But in the meantime, what can we, I hesitate to say this because I'm for fear of false hope and promoting what you say is not an accurate solution. But I mean, in the meantime, what can people do, barring suicide, to maybe try to see things over without this catastrophic reduction in our population overall? How do I, as an individual, make a difference?
Sure. One thing is, the nice thing about being alive is that we are all going to die. Mm-hmm. And honestly, if we could just reproduce at less than replacement numbers, it would take care of itself in the end, and it wouldn't have to be catastrophic. So, we need to ask questions about, what are the social forces behind this level of overpopulation? So you've got poverty, you've got male-dominated societies, and you also have this just tremendous hegemony of corporate control because, this whole process I described, how there's, the power base and then it's got the conquered colonies around it. And that's what the rich countries are doing now. And especially, the corporate power mongers at the center of it, they have gone around the world and destroyed every local sustainable community that they found and turned them all into serfs, essentially, stripped their land of, every resource that the industrial rich nations would like to have. And people at one point might have been able to provide for their own food in local communities. They can't anymore because those local economies have been destroyed. We will never save this planet as long as there is corporate personhood. Corporate power and this idea of capitalism, of, wealth as its own good to be accumulated, that's no way to run an economy. I mean, until very recently, the economies that people lived with, they may have been market economies, but those market economies were nestled inside larger moral economies in which everybody had a say in what the basic price of goods would be, how much should be produced, and the morality here was that everybody needed to be fed and that, wealth for its own sake was a bizarre concept. That is over. That age is over. The barons of the age dismantled it all 300 years ago, and we've been stuck with this insane capitalist system ever since. We can reverse that. I mean, we can fight that. We can make that stop. Now, on a local level, people always have these questions about, what should I do? What's the most important thing? If you want to talk specifically about food, there are, in fact, some really good guidelines that would help. So you've got three questions to ask. The first is soil. Food in front of you, the food that you want to buy, does that build topsoil or does it destroy topsoil? If you are looking at a plate of wheat or soy or corn, you are destroying topsoil, and that is the terrible fact. If you are looking at a plateful of grass-fed beef from a local farm or venison that you got yourself from a local forest, that is food that could go on forever because it's building topsoil. It's animals and plants working together in a soil community. It's nature's template. It's animals integrated into perennial polycultures. So head for that food. Head for the food that builds topsoil. And there's wonderful websites now that can help you find farmers that are doing, what they call grass-based farming. So it's all in perennial cover, and they are building topsoil at an astounding rate.
Well, there
is still tremendous hope.
Well, sorry, Leah, Keith, I'm, there is tons we could go on about, but for, sadly, we're out of time, like the planet, I fear.
Yeah.
But could you give us your website for those computer-capable in the audience who want to link up with more about your book and some of the links that you mentioned?
Wonderful. My website is my name, which would be easy, except my name is hard to spell. So it's L-I-E-R-R-E. K-E-I-T-H LierKeith.com. So honestly, if you just Google vegetarian fit, you will find my website.
Okay, well, Lier Keith, and it's like Pierre with an L instead of a P.
Exactly.
LierKeith.com. Thanks a lot, Lier, for coming on the program. It's a most thought-provoking and terrifying, and I wish you all the luck with your book.
I'm sorry, and thank you.
All right, then. Bye-bye. Well, that's a sobering little bit of news. I'm going to take a brief break here, and if I don't hang myself in the studio, I'll be joined in a moment by Jeanine Bancroft, so do stick around for that.
The UVic Global Water Brigades is hosting a fundraiser called Vital on December 4th at the Legacy Gallery and Cafe from 8 to 10:30 p.m. The night will be filled with a silent auction, art, music, and of course refreshments. This is an opportunity for you to engage with your community while helping to raise funds so that the Water Brigades can help develop their safe water initiative in Honduras. Legacy Gallery is located at 630 Yates Street, and check out globalbrigades.org for more information.
And welcome back to Guerrilla Radio, CFUV 101.9 FM, 104.3 on the cable, and around the world at cfuv.uvic.ca. Well, I survived that interview, and I am indeed joined by Jeanine Bancroft. Hey, Jeanine, how's it going?
Well, Chris, I don't know whether to kill myself or my children, or I got to kill something, though, because that apparently is the best way to sustain the planet.
Ah, geez, I don't know. I mean, I guess... I don't know. I mean, it's pretty horrifying, and there's I've got a lot of facts here from you know Lier's book, and she mentions Canada. You know, 99% of the topsoil on our prairies is you know pretty much toast. I mean, it's all supported by you know petrochemical fertilizers, and that, and yeah, you know, it's pretty frightening stuff.
Well, there's a lot to consider there, and certainly I don't think the argument boils down to should we eat local animals or should we destroy the rainforest for soy? Like to me that's what I'm hearing on Facebook too in response to an article that's up about meat now being grown in a laboratory. So you can eat meat without feeling any
yummy.
Any guilt whatsoever, I guess.
What is it? It's grown to want to be eaten?
Yeah, that's it. So I don't know. I think she kind of got me with the part about the patriarchy and the oppression and the imperialism. But, you know, taking another living life is pretty much the pinnacle of oppression, I think. So, yeah, permaculture and then I guess... I don't know, Chris. Yeah, there's breatharians. You know, we got to join the ranks of the breatharians, although I have yet to meet one.
Yeah, well, I've never met one either, so there you go. But, I mean, with the quality of the air these days, I mean, that's a whole other issue, isn't it?
Oh, there you go. Yeah, I don't know how long they last at all. But, hey, did you hear Democracy Now! Today?
I heard some of Amy talking about her adventures with the Canadian Border Service. Is that what you're talking about?
We really all got to thank the Canadian Border Services for raising the issue of the Olympics onto Democracy Now! And yeah, they actually used video from a locally produced B channel here from the Torch protest and from Indie Media.
Oh, did they? Oh, really? Oh, great.
They did, and they had Chris Shaw, who's the author.
Mm-hmm. Hey? Oh, sorry, go ahead.
The author of The Five Ring Circus, and they had David Eby, who's the executive director of the BC Civil Liberties Association. And so if people go to the website at democracynow.org, it's all downloadable.
Well,
and
yeah.
If folks want to continue being part of the Olympic protest, now that we're on the international stage officially, there's a meeting this Thursday in Victoria at 6 p.m. at Camus Books. There's also stuff happening in Vancouver, of course, and the weekend that looks like it's going to be a big weekend is the weekend of February 6th and 7th. On the 6th, there's a squelcher parade being organized, which has to do with having a giant fire extinguisher greet the torch or somewhere in the vicinity. And then on the 7th is the third annual Poverty Olympics, which proves to be lots of fun. I think that last year they actually sold out the place, and it's at the Japanese Language School. So if people are wanting to participate, I would suggest that would be the weekend.
Well, maybe Jane, just a small recap for those people that didn't hear Democracy Now! Today and weren't at the Amy Goodman talk that was right upstairs from the studios here in the Student Union Building at the University of Victoria last Thursday. Amy was here, and this was very fresh for her because it had only happened, I guess, the day before as she crossed on the mainland to go speak in Vancouver. Can you flesh it out a little bit, Janine?
Well, all I know, Chris, is that Amy and I, we live parallel lives. We cross borders. We get hauled aside by the authorities. Now, in her case, they actually were asking her what was going to be in the contents of her speech. She tells the story much better than I could, but it's a little bit alarming that this is what they were concerned about, and they kept prodding her about what she was going to be talking about, and then they finally said, are you going to be speaking about the Olympics? By the time she got back out to her car, they were rifling through things. They were looking actually on their laptops, at anything could have been their sources, that they're trying to protect or anything. So in any event, they were held up for about an hour and a half. I don't know if she got the same sort of feeling up treatment that I did when I was crossing back, having come from a humanitarian aid mission in Cuba, and got treated with similar disdain by the U.S. authorities. So there's definitely a harmonization of interests going on there.
Yeah, well, that's little Jason Kenney is the Minister for Immigration. He's responsible for the border services, and it's just been one hit after another with this clown. I mean, George Galloway, the episode there last year, and this, and we've seen other activists on various issues, Americans being turned away.
David,
I think, well, anyway, he was the author of his own misfortune, I think, in that one to a large degree, but I mean...
Alison Bodine
definitely wasn't, and this was another very similar sense where she was, because of the political materials, that posters and literature that she had in her car when she was crossing the border, they looked at that and then, used that as the basis to turn her away. So this is denying the Canadian people the right to hear different versions of reality that don't necessarily jive with Mr. Harper. I Mr. Harper, before he was elected Prime Minister, he promised that after he was done, you wouldn't recognize Canada. Well, it's already getting that way, and he looks like he's got a little bit more time to go yet. So for those people, these old people like me that remember what Canada was, please get involved and try to unseat this guy and make the Liberals realize that if they are just going to be a clone of Mr. Harper's Conservatives, then we'll vote NDP or not at all or whatever. I mean, just we got to get out of this this movement towards fascism that we're galloping towards, it seems to me.
Yeah, it's ironic too that today is actually the 10-year anniversary of the Battle of Seattle, right? And the 10-year anniversary of the birth of indie media, so that we actually have a way to communicate about these horrible things that are going on. And one thing that David Eby said is, he was sort of cautioning anybody, I think, is the interpretation I got. If you're coming up here for Olympic protests, and we hope that you are, if you're peaceful sort, don't tell them, really be careful at that border. And he actually said, either he or Chris said today on the radio to Amy, if you had told them you were going to be speaking about the Olympics, I'm willing to bet they wouldn't have let you into the country.
Yeah, this is shocking. And who are these guys that run the Olympics? But, you'll see them at these big financial meetings around the world. They're the same characters. These guys, they live in a whole another universe, and democracy is not a part of their agenda. And sadly, we're seeing the ascension of these vicious elitists. And this makes our democracy, everything our troops are over there fighting for, our troops. I don't have any troops, by the way, but not even one troop. But, it really makes a mockery of our whole nation that we would bend over and for these the Olympic Committee and wipe out our whole democracy and all the rules that we've developed over, almost two centuries just because, they don't like democracy.
Yeah. And speaking of which, David Johnston is back in jail, eh?
Oh, is he?
And he's been sentenced to 45 days, and he doesn't eat while he's in jail, so he's guilty of setting up a tent in Centennial Square.
Which isn't a crime, by the way. Not in this province. According to the Supreme Court of British Columbia, that is a perfectly legal thing to do.
Well, except that the Supreme Court decision is being appealed, or it was, you know, yawn way back in the spring. We're still waiting. We're not sure why it takes them so long to make a decision about whether they're going to uphold that or not,
okay.
Right? I know it's all crazy. We should all just all kill ourselves. Like, no, she didn't suggest that.
Well,
I wonder if she's getting paid by the meat industry, though, the milk and dairy industry.
No, hunting lobby, maybe. But the meat and dairy, they feed grains to their animals, you know, amongst other things. And she says she's dead against all that, and she's all for all of those other reasons that people become vegetarian and vegan. But hey, Janine, we're out of time. The street news is out for December on the streets of Victoria. Your show, you're not this Thursday, but next Thursday with Winds of Change, Thursday at 11 a.m. right here. And sorry to rush you off there, Janine, but I just looked at the clock and we're running a bit long. But any final words there?
It's a World AIDS Day tomorrow, and I hope everybody's,
speaking
not
of depopulation.
Jump off a cliff.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. That. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That is something.
moving on.
Yeah. Moving right along. I'm going to be joined by Dave Lindorf in the second half. We're going to talk about some war criminals and stuff. Finally, something that we can lighten up about. Okay. Thanks a lot, Janine.
Thank you, Chris.
All right. Bye bye.
Sunday morning after the revolution, we drove homemade the beds we would lie in. Pockets full of papers, papers full of headlines. Took some pictures to prove we had a good time. Now I'm flying here while the fire still burns outside. Get up in the morning, heads full of sleep, and we listen to the news as we drink our coffee. Didn't need to be there, you can watch it all on TV. But now we know that they're only telling half the story, 'cause we were there, we saw the dancing and the drums. And what they are showing us looks like a battlefield, but what they fail to mention is why they had to build a wall around the leaders, as if they were in jail, or as if they were an empire about to fall. Friday night, for the revolution, I thought I'd call you. Thought maybe the solution was to take my courage and to walk into that landmine. But 3 in the morning came, and then it was closing time. And I know you well enough to know that it's too late to call. And sure, love can be, love can be a battlefield, and sure I made my protest, tried to break down the wall. Inside some countries, people disappear, and maybe I am one of them, or maybe we're the empire that's about to fall. Still rising when we hit the road, gotta get there to make history. The old Dodge rumbles toward the trouble in the city.
Evelyn Perry, Canada's Own, from her album Unreasonable. Yeah, as Janine mentioned, 10 years today since the battle for Seattle. Wow, man, look at how much has changed since. Well, in Great Britain, hearings are being conducted into just how that country became entangled in the Iraq War. Astonishing testimony was released last week regarding secret meetings held between George W. Bush and Tony Blair that suggests the two men plotted the invasion well before any of the supposed justification for such an action was merited. The astonishing part in all that, of course, is that the British media feigned surprise at facts established nearly 8 years ago. Dave Lindorf is an award-winning investigative reporter and author active in journalism for more than 3 decades. He's the author of the books This Can't Be Happening, Resisting the Disintegration of American Democracy, Marketplace Medicine, The Rise of the For-Profit Hospital Chains, Killing Time, an investigation into the death row case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, and he's co-author with Barbara Olshansky of The Case for Impeachment, Legal Arguments for Removing George W. Bush from Office. Welcome back to the show, Dave.
Hi, I'm glad to be back.
Well, my pleasure, of course. Now, well, first off, Dave, now what's this British commission hoping to accomplish?
Well, the Chilcot inquiry was, you have to realize, was reluctantly put in motion by Gordon Brown, current prime minister. Mm-hmm. It's a case where you have an enormously unpopular war. The British public is wildly opposed to war and has been since it began, more so even than in the U.S. It has not got the power to put people under oath and, you know, or indict anybody, but it's an investigative commission, much like the 9/11 commission turned out to be. However, it's developing some pretty fascinating testimony that pretty well nails it, that, you know, the important thing for us in the U.S. is that we're hearing that Bush was pushing for war, you know, a year before we got in there. And you know, this, it's not like it's news in the sense that we've had evidence about this going all the way back to the first meeting of the National Security Council when Bush took office as president. But this is pretty dramatic stuff when you hear that, for example, the latest testimony that at the Crawford Ranch in April 2002, Blair was telling Bush in response to pressure from Bush that he was willing to have Britain go to war to topple Saddam Hussein if they couldn't use the sanctions regime that they had to get him to stop supposedly going in the direction of making these fictitious weapons of mass destruction.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm a little bit at a loss, Dave, because I haven't paid a lot of attention to the corporate media for, I don't know, quite a long time. And all of this stuff, I mean, we had Joe Wilson, for example, and the whole yellow cake thing. This was one of the justifications was that, you know, Saddam was trying to build a nuke. I mean, as much as they're doing with Iran today, they tried to convince the world that there was an imminent threat to the United States and the Western world, or anybody, I don't know who, but that Saddam Hussein would be dropping nukes. And as Condoleezza Rice, who's rather invisible these days, said, you know, we don't want the wake-up call to be a mushroom cloud. I mean, there was that one. And then the Downing Street memos that covered much of what this commission must be covering now, with these, where they had the minutes memos of discussions between Blair and Bush, and basically saying, you know, with a wink and a nod, saying, well, yeah, okay, we can sort of make a case here. We'll do this, that, and the other. And as you say, this was like in 2002. I mean, how do we draw this together? People like me, who I'm a bit bifurcated here between what the corporate media is saying today and echoes of what we've been reading on the internet and on sites like yours, that this can't be happening, you know, for years. You know, how do we sort of bring this together to disseminate what's news
well,
and what isn't?
I think that's the big point, is that at least for people in Britain, now, you know, very little of this is being covered in the U.S., and it's going on the back pages of papers like the New York Times and the Washington Post, not the front pages, where it should be, because they haven't covered it before. So,
yeah.
So for them, it's news. What it is that, and I think the reason you're having this peculiar feeling about it is old news. It's been admirably reported by many people for years now. But what we're getting is, first of all, a richer tapestry of the level of deception and the venality of the deception that was going on in Britain and in the U.S. through these hearings, because you've got a lot of people testifying now. I think a lot of people are trying to sort of unburden themselves and say what they knew. And So you're getting a portrait now of Blair as a complete liar, a complete fraud, and of Bush and Cheney as this single-minded crew who were pushing for this war at all costs and bullying Britain into being an accomplice in it. So and the second part of it is that it is, all, these stories are getting into the corporate media. In Britain, they're all over the papers. They're in the Daily Mail, they're in the Telegraph, they're in the Guardian, they're in the BBC, they're in the Independent. You can't avoid the stories over there, and they're page one. And that inevitably is leaking over here into the U.S., where we've had a virtual blackout in the corporate media on any of this stuff.
Well, not just the corporate media. You know, Dave, in Canada, unlike the United States, we have state media, and it's supposed to be head and shoulders above the rest, and that's the CBC, of course, the Canadian Broadcast Network, corporation, rather. Corporate, but not yet corporate, but they've been cheerleading for the war, not only the war in Iraq from day one, or before day one, but also the war in Afghanistan. Mr. Obama is promising to convince Americans that trillions more are worth spending on war tomorrow evening, but he made the decision yesterday that there's going to be an increase in American military force in Afghanistan. What about this, Dave? Is there any crossover here with the British Commission into how Britain got involved in the Afghanistan fiasco, or is that something that's just totally separate and beyond thinking?
I think there is. I mean, I read a story today that Britain is saying it's going to have all its troops out of Afghanistan in a year, which doesn't sound like the kind of thing you say if you're wholeheartedly supporting the kind of escalation that that Obama is calling for. He's really effectively will have doubled the U.S. troops in Afghanistan in less than his first year in office, with every evidence being that he's going to increase it further. So, I mean, it's becoming kind of ridiculous when you have, as of now, there are 100,000 troops there, counting the troops from European countries and Australia, and there are, at best, 100 people associated with what's called Al-Qaeda, and at best, I've heard as low as 3,000 fully trained Taliban fighters. And somehow, 100,000 of the top armed troops in the world are bogged down and losing to that enemy.
God, well, it's...
And adding troops is supposed to change the calculus. I don't think so.
Well, and these numbers don't include how many mercenaries that we don't know are in there. I mean, we know there's almost an equal number.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. So we're probably talking closer to... it's hard to know who's fighting, Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of those guys are food service personnel.
They're contractors,
but there are
yeah.
fighters, too. It's a safe bet if you say that an army runs on its stomach, then those are fighters in a sense. So, we may have as many as 150,000 size military over there, and we're fighting 3,000 fully armed and trained Taliban and maybe another 10,000 semi-trained part-time fighters.
Well, if you just tuned in, you're listening.
And losing.
Yeah. Well, can there be victory? If you just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria, 104.3 on the cable, and CFUV.uvic.ca on the internet. I'm speaking tonight with Dave Lindorf, and Dave is an award-winning investigative reporter, an author active in journalism for more than three decades. His books include This Can't Be Happening, Resisting the Disintegration of American Democracy, Marketplace Medicine, The Rise of the For-Profit Hospital Chains, Killing Time, an Investigation into the Death Row Case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, and with Barbara Olshan, The Case for Impeachment, Legal Arguments for Removing George W. Bush from Office. Well, Dave, when you mentioned this single-mindedness of the Bush-Cheney cabal, I wonder about that because we see so little change. Both Gordon Brown is a sort of a lesser clone of his master, Blair, and now the Great Black Hope Obama is following, I mean, George Bush would have done absolutely nothing different other than said some stupid things in the last year that we could laugh at. But I see absolutely no change whatsoever. Is there a hope, do you think, Dave, that one day we'll have a commission to find out who the people behind these people that are supposedly leading us are?
I'm not optimistic in this country. I mean, I think that the difference between Britain and the U.S. is that journalists in the corporate media in Britain still take their jobs seriously, and the newspapers there still actually perform some of the normal functions of journalists, which is to ask, you know, halfway probing questions. It doesn't happen here anymore. We really barely have a journalism profession in our corporate media. And sadly, although there are many other sources of news, like the places I tend to write for, it's very hard to get ordinary Americans to read or view those media. So we just don't have any more a media that digs out these questions and forces the issue, and the public is so somnolent that we're not getting any kind of traction on a peace movement or anything. So I am not optimistic that we're going to get to the bottom of any of this.
Well, I mean, that's a tough thing for someone like you to say, Dave. You're with the Writers Union, and you've been a journalist for a long time, and you went into journalism presumably thinking that, you know, you could do good work and make a difference. Geez, do you really think that it's just throwing pearls? I mean, what rare real journalism there is just throwing pearls before the swine? I mean, do you think that the people really are what the corporate media have been telling us all these years, just a bunch of dumbasses that don't care for anything beyond their football and beer?
I'm increasingly feeling that that's the case. You know, you're really you can do incredible stories, and they just fly off into space. People don't pick them up. They don't have any traction. It's very, very rarely that a story about, you know, systemic issues makes it into the popular awareness area. An example of this would be the story that James Risen did in the New York Times exposing the massive spying by the NSA, where that did break through ultimately after being held for a year, broke through to the front page of the New York Times and from there all over the media. And it did kind of wake people up and upset a lot of people, and it got some traction. But even then, you know, the government was able to, through the propaganda of fear, to get people to pretty much buy into, well, you know, they have to do that.
Well, this is the NSA, of course.
But you could see how hard that, even something that dramatic and that blatantly in violation of the Constitution was, took a year of pressure, and really Risen willing to go public in it with his own book to force the Times to publish it.
Well, this is
that's pretty sad.
This is the National Security Agency, sort of the overarching octopi of all these other, you know, the CIA being just one tentacle of it, and the unwarranted wiretapping. Is that what you're talking about? Unwarranted?
Yeah.
And hooked up with the telephone
companies.
That was
broken by a New York Times reporter, but held by the editors at the Times for a year.
Yeah, well, that's, it astonishes me that they even printed it. There must have been a pressure from the internet for them to do that.
Well, he got a book contract, and he had it in the book. And what happened was that the Times ultimately was going to be embarrassed by having their reporter break the story in his book, so they finally came out with it.
Yeah, well,
so he forced the issue.
We were talking earlier here, Dave, about the experience of Amy Goodman from Democracy Now! At the border in Canada a few days ago, or last Wednesday evening.
Uh-huh.
Are you aware of any of that?
Just what I've read about it, that she was stopped at the border.
Well, they rifled through her laptop and her associate's laptop and went through the. I mean, I know in the United States that this is, you know, the security of your papers, which you can extend to your personal computer, is something that is protected in the Constitution. In Canada, well, maybe not so much so, but basically, that's what they did there. They just grabbed it and just whatever, you know, and started going through all of this stuff. And what they would say, and this is because she was going, you know, they suspected, oh my God, that she might say something bad about the impending Olympics here in Vancouver. But ultimately, when they get challenged on this, and I certainly hope she sues them or something, but, you know, it will be, well, we've got to be secure, you know, to make sure that, you know, Amy Goodman isn't coming here to blow up the Olympic Games or anything, you know. I mean, it's...
Yeah, right, the terrorist Amy Goodman.
Well, Dave, of course, the Internet now...
Yeah, of course, you know, you're not quite right, though. The customs authorities have been routinely rifling through people's computers at the U.S. border crossings, too. Business people coming back have objected to having their computers taken and, you know, searched through. And it's becoming pretty commonplace here that customs officers do that, and they claim they have the right to do it at the border.
And that doesn't violate the First Amendment?
Yeah, that's becoming a pretty spongy amendment.
like all the others. There's a bit of malleability there, eh? Well,
yeah, it's taken a real beating.
Oh, man. Well, Dave, now you've got a website, and I mentioned it earlier, thiscan'tbehappening.net, and, you know, writers like you and other people that are not welcomed necessarily in the corporate media, or they can't stomach the restrictions that, you know, writing for those kinds of outlets demand. They, you know, go to the Internet, start their own sites, or go to some of the few very major sites. How are you making a go of it at your site? I mean, can you make a living as a journalist from the website that you
No. I get about, it's running at about $3,000 a year in donations to that site. It's, you know, because it's only me. I think people, or, you know, the sites like Common Dreams or Truth Out that are running a lot of writers are having a slightly easier time. That's not where my money comes from. I write books and I write for magazines that pay me. Mm-hmm. So without that, I would be a fairly hungry guy.
Well, so what does that
say? This website doesn't do it on its own.
What does that say for the aspiring journalists at the University of Victoria and other schools who would like to make a living in this, and they're not in it just to go into the public relations industry? Should they maybe change their major?
If they're going into it for the money, I would say yes. I mean, I think journalism schools at this point, particularly in the U.S., and I can't speak for Canada, but it's probably similar, are basically a fraud, because they're not teaching a career that anybody can make a living in. It can't stay this way, let me say that. I mean, there's going to have to be a new model, and you know, eventually I'm sure something will come up that'll pay the freight, because people are relying right now on sites like mine and others for their news. But somebody has to write it, and those people do have to make a living somehow.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, for the time being, I just urge people to support sites, you know, whether mine or others that they read. I think people need to learn to think in terms of, if I value this, I should make a contribution to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I know that you're right now mounting an annual campaign to get your funds up. And Dave, your site again is thiscan'tbehappening.net, all one word, thiscan'tbehappening. That is right. It is .net, right, Nick?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, okay. thiscan'tbehappening.net for Dave Lindorf's site. Well, Dave, it's always interesting to talk to you. Sadly, we're out of time for tonight. But I do wish you success on all the books you've got out there. And again, the latest one is The Case for Impeachment. It's a bit of a drag. George Bush is gone now, but maybe we
I have to do a new one. I think we're developing a situation where it may be that our new president is a criminal too.
Well, that he'll be in a crowded room of presidents at that trial. Well, again, thanks a lot, Dave, for coming on the show, Dave Lindorf, and thanks to Liar Keith, liarkeith.com. You can check out her site. Oh boy, that's pretty sad. And Janine and all the people up here. Thanks again, Dave.
Okay, thanks for having me, Chris.
All right, bye bye. Now I'm going to play myself out again with more from the wonderful Evelyn Perry, and remind you, especially jazz fans, to stick around, because Arnold's coming straight up with rhythming you into this last day of November, 10 years from Seattle.
As if they were in jail. or as if they were an empire about to fall. Friday night, before the revolution, I thought I'd call you, thought maybe the solution was to take my courage and to walk into that landmine, but 3 in the morning came.